From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the 4-inch-wide ledge of the bell tower on the 6th story of a school in Indiana. A 12th grade student named Theodore Finch was in the throes of another extended bout of depression, and he had climbed out to the ledge to think about jumping, to think about dying. In fact, in these bouts with depression, he thought about dying rather constantly. That morning, he asked himself, "Is today a good day to die? Maybe this time I'll do it. Let the air carry me away. It will be like floating in a pool, drifting off until there's nothing." But that morning on that ledge, Finch noticed something. He wasn't alone up there. A girl named Violet Markey had climbed out to the ledge to consider exactly the same ending. And so Finch did what came naturally to him. He quirkily asked her, "Come here often? Because this is kind of my spot, and I don't remember seeing you here before." Well, Finch and Violet got off that ledge, became friends, and more than that. Their story is fiction, told in a new novel, All the Bright Places, by Jennifer Niven. It debuted on the New York Times bestseller list at number 13, just 5 days after publication. It's being read in more than 30 countries, on track, I think, to become a movie, and in the world of young adult fiction, it has become a meteoric success, focusing on delicate themes, including depression and suicide. As one online reviewer wrote, quote, "I loved The Fault in Our Stars, but this book spoke to me even more." Well, this weekend, Jennifer Niven will be in Rochester as a guest of the 10th annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest. But first, she's my guest on Connections. Thank you so much for being here, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations on the success of All the Bright Places, and deservedly so. It is, I think you've tackled some very, very difficult subjects. And I just want to start with the question of how you alighted on these subject matters at all as an author. You know how I think how heavy they are and how the audience can connect, but also feel so emotional about them. Why depression and suicide?
I actually was really writing something that a story that I knew because I loved this boy years ago, a boyfriend of mine, who I struggled with bipolar and depression, and I saw firsthand what it, you know, just the struggle he had to be in the world every single day. At the same time, he was one of the most alive people I have ever known, and it just, knowing him was such a profound experience for me, and I knew one day I wanted to write that story and write about him. And it, you know, because it was so personal, I wasn't sure that I was able, you know, would ever be able to. And then 2 summers ago, I sat down to just try it and see if I could do it.
And you did. And did you have any inkling when it was happening, when you were writing the story of Finch and Violet, that it would be the story it is today and it would garner the response that it has?
No, not at all. I mean, I really just wrote from such a personal place, and I just, you know, I was writing thinking maybe no one will ever want to read this. I don't know, but it's such an important story to me to tell, and I just, I hope that it will just reach the right people, the people who need it most. And I've been completely overwhelmed by the response. It's been amazing and wonderful.
We're going to talk about some of that and the way this has connected people, people who might suffer from depression or have thoughts of suicide. But I also want to make it clear that, it's a work of fiction, but there in the book at the end, after the book concludes, you have some words about suicide and help. And I know you take that very seriously as an author. It was clear in the book and it was clear in what was written at the very end there. I kind of just wanted to make sure our audience understands it was not treated flippantly in any way.
Absolutely. I think so much of what's being written in YA literature is very brave and bold and daring, and it's one reason I wanted to be in that world. And but at the same time, I think there is the tendency and the danger to romanticize or to be a little flippant. And with something like this, a subject like this, I just feel like you have a great duty and responsibility to be as honest as possible. And that's one reason I wanted to write the story that I wrote.
So Finch is, in many ways, your ex-boyfriend?
In many ways. You know, it's funny with characters. You start out and they may be inspired by someone or kind of a group of hybrid of people you know in real life, but they inevitably take on their own personas and become their own kind of entities in your mind. So now when I think of Finch, I don't think of my ex-boyfriend. I think of Finch. he just feels like his own complete person to me. But he was definitely inspired by this person I knew.
And given the relationship you had with someone who was living with bipolar, living with depression, did you, when you decided to tackle it from a literary perspective, did you want to interview other people who go through it? Did you do a lot of research on suicide and depression? Did you talk to therapists? How did you sort of approach that part of it?
I definitely did. I mean, I started my career in nonfiction, and that kind of research, you know, instinct is always there in anything that I write, no matter what it is, especially with something that, you know, deals with heavier topics like this. So I talked to people who experience bipolar, who are bipolar, people with depression. I also talked to experts in the field. I read a lot of memoirs and interviewed just personal accounts of living with bipolar and depression. And but I mean, in all of that, at the end of the day, the thing that really informed Finch the most was this boy I knew. And with Violet, I gave her, I've known a lot of loss in my life, and I gave her, kind of gave all of that to her. So that was something, you know, I knew and had experienced firsthand.
The characters, Violet and Finch, might meet on that ledge where they're both thinking about the way their lives might end at the very beginning, but they are very different. Finch dealing with those awake periods, I thought that was such an interesting way to characterize what he goes through. And thinking about dying, especially when he is in the throes of those awake periods, whereas Violet is, fair to say, Jennifer, they may meet in the same place, but they're very different.
That's a great way of saying it. They really are. I mean, he's kind of considered the freak at school because no one understands all of these extremes that he goes through, and he doesn't understand them either. And Violet is more popular. She's well-liked, and she's, you know, had a pretty great life up until about 9 months earlier when her sister died in a car crash that Violet survived, which is why Violet's up on that ledge. So these are two people who never would have had anything to do with each other had they not both found themselves in this extreme situation.
And then we kind of take the journey with them as their relationship deepens, and Finch, again, he's a very layered character to me in that he has a feeling of kind of isolation. There are moments where he'll be sitting in class feeling like that he can't even remember the last 5 minutes, that he's kind of just drifting. But then he'll have a moment where he thinks, is everyone looking at him, or is he alone? Or it's a very interesting dynamic and mix. And it felt to me like you must have known people intimately who go through it, even though depression is so different from person to person. I mean, they say our brains are like snowflakes, and depression in many ways is. It hits people differently. But it left me wondering, were you working with editors and people around you just to kind of craft some of those moments? Did you ask people, is this authentic? Or once you started writing, did it kind of just pour out of you?
I think it just, I mean, really just pulled out of me, just again from knowing this boy who I knew for about 2 years, and we lived together at one point. And so it was really like, in some ways, his experience was my experience, because it was just such an intimate kind of up close look at what he went through. And we talked about it a great deal, because he was, unlike Finch, he was diagnosed. But I've known other people as well. I have family members and friends who have also gone through it. And as you say, everyone does it in a different way. But I knew that there were some similarities. I mean, when Finch is in those awake periods, as he calls them, he feels invincible, and he feels as if he could do anything. He has this boundless energy. And, you know, he can't sleep. He just runs, and he has all this exuberance, which can be overwhelming to the people around him. And then when he begins to shut down and go to the asleep periods, as he calls them, it really feels like a switch is almost just shutting off, and he goes blank. And I think that was something in all the people I talked to, and certainly the boy I knew, that's something that I kept seeing and hearing.
For our listeners who know anyone, and I suspect anyone listening to this program right now, knows someone with depression, loves someone with depression. And what I connected to so much about Finch in those moments of sort of the shutdown and the change, of the switch that you just heard Jennifer describe, is that, you know, I have known people who are the most intelligent, dutiful employees, family members, and they hit these throws and they just stop going to work. They say, well, I don't feel like it. I don't have it in me. I can't get out of bed. Mm-hmm. And for someone like me, who I don't have depression, it is so hard to understand that. And I think what this book does really well is it forces us to confront just how severe those changes and the way it can impact us is. And so I just commend you for that, Jennifer, because I've seen it in my own life and people around me. And the instinct for people who don't have depression sometimes is to say, well, just stop doing that. Why are you behaving that way? And, right. You know, you never know how that's going to help. But generally, that doesn't help, I guess, Jennifer.
Exactly. And you're so right about that. And I think that, you know, it's easy to be impatient and say, well, just, you know, perk up and feel good.
Right.
And think about positive things. But it's really more of an illness than anything else. And that's the thing, it needs to be recognized as such. And there's such a stigma, I think, with mental health issues and depression. And that was one thing, you know, that wasn't why I wrote the book, but it's one thing that I feel very passionate about and felt that way when I was writing this story, that, you know, I know this boy that I knew, I think if he had felt been made to feel as if it were okay to talk about and okay to have something like this and acknowledge that you're struggling with it, it would have helped him tremendously. And I think that's something that people really need to know, that, you know, it's okay. And we all have things, and, you know, you just need to not be ashamed or be afraid.
We're talking to Jennifer Niven. Her newest book, All the Bright Places, has become a great success. And she's going to be in Rochester Saturday, Nazareth College. It's the 10th annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest. It's from about 8:45 to 5 p.m. About 30 young adult authors will be out there, and you can meet them. There will be different seminars. We're going to talk a little bit later this hour about all the things coming up on Saturday, but it's always a great event, and Jennifer will be here for that. And let me get this out of the way now, Jennifer, because I know you probably deal with this. This is probably the eye roll question by now, which is a lovingly admirable question, but I have to ask it simply because when I read the reviews, it comes up all the time. This is a great time, I think, for a book like this to come out, because a lot of people are looking at what's so hot and what's so popular, and they say, yeah, this reminds me of Fault in Our Stars in some ways. And I know you didn't set out to write The Fault in Our Stars or anything like that. I hope that you take that as praise, first of all.
I do, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I had not read The Fault in Our Stars until after I wrote this book. And I had read a couple of John Green's, you know, earlier books, but I had not read that one. I was one of the few people at that point. But I can definitely see why they say that. I think of it as high praise, because I think he's a terrific writer. I love being compared to him. You know, the only thing I always want to make sure people know is I didn't write it because of it.
Sure, absolutely.
I'm thrilled to be in the same breath as him.
And I just bring that up for our listeners who are wondering, hey, I haven't heard of the book yet. Yes, it is earning that kind of comparison and that kind of praise. And the title, All the Bright Places, let our listeners know what the title refers to.
The title is, it's interesting because it originally was entitled You Make Me Lovely, and we ended up changing that because Random House felt the word lovely might be a little off-putting to some of the male readers they were hoping would pick up the book, and so we changed it to All the Bright Places, and I found that line from Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go, and I just loved the sound of it because Finch and Violet in the book, they wander their state of Indiana, where they're living. And Finch helps Violet look at Indiana, this place that she really does not like. And he helps her see the bright places all around them, not just in Indiana, but the people around them, too. I think he really helps her look at places and people in a totally different light. And so the name, I mean, we found it after I had written that, but it fit perfectly.
And the book itself is one that, again, I described as young adult. And we're going to talk a little bit more this hour, later this hour, with another young adult author who might not like to be called a young adult author. And I laugh at that because I have friends who write fiction, write literature. A good friend of mine moved out to San Francisco. Her newest book, she was so in love with this book. It meant so much to her. And her agent said, yeah, it would do really well with YA. And she says, wait a second, don't pigeonhole it as YA. And the agent said, well, that's the audience. That's who connects with it. But some authors are sensitive about that genre or that pigeonholing. And I'm curious how you feel about it, Jennifer.
You know, it's interesting because I've written, as I said, I started my career in nonfiction for adults. I moved on to historical fiction for adults. And I've written a memoir. So I've kind of been all over the map because I didn't like being pigeonholed. But the thing about YA, I'm proud to say I'm right now a YA author. In fact, I feel like in some ways it's where I'm most at home. And I think it's so exciting because there's so much, as I said, there's so much great stuff being done in YA. I feel like in many ways it's the genre that has the most amazing creative, bold material being produced right now. And so I'm really proud and really excited when I hear myself called a YA author because it's been a place I've wanted to be for a long time.
The book is All the Bright Places. Jennifer Niven on the line with us. And when you are writing All the Bright Places, did you know before you wrote the first paragraph how it would end?
I did. And I did because, and that's a question I get a lot, but I did just because it's the ending I knew in real life. And I knew I wanted to write that story. Not only the story, that was inspired by this boy I knew, but the story that I knew too, that I had experienced.
Was it, I don't want to give away too much for the audience, but I think it's important to point out here that the book is an emotional read, and it tackles these issues in sometimes very tough ways. Was it emotional for you to write certain parts of it?
Absolutely. I had a young writer ask me recently, because she's working on a book that she feels very close to, and she said it's a very emotional book for her, and she said, how do I write it without crying? And I said, you have to cry, because if you don't let yourself cry and feel all those emotions as you're writing it, your reader is not going to feel anything when he or she is reading it. And so I definitely cried when I wrote it. I was very emotional, but I also had fun when I wrote it too, because it's, there's a lot of lightness in the book as well and humor. And so it was a roller coaster to write, but it was, in the end, it was just felt, I think it was the book that I put the most of my heart into. So it was a wonderful experience.
I want to talk about some of the feedback and so much of the review. So many of the reviews have been so positive. And I imagine that's just as exhilarating as ever, even though Jennifer is a veteran author who's written in different genres. But I also know that when you write about depression, and when you write about suicide, it can be very sensitive, and some people will have differences of opinions. And I want to get your take, Jennifer. Here's some comments from a woman named Alex Townsend. She's a writer who also has depression, and she reviewed the book on her blog. And here's what she wrote. She said it was very difficult as someone with depression to read the book. And she writes this, quote, Violet and Finch both evolve entirely through talking to each other, whimsical adventures, and abstract philosophy. While those things might help some people, things like therapy and medication are often essential. In All the Bright Places, both standard treatment methods are shown in a very negative light. Therapists are well-meaning adults who don't really understand, or at worst, they will put in minimal effort to try and get the depressed kid back in line. No one explains the benefits of antidepressants. Instead, any hint of medical treatment is treated with disgust in the book. That's what Alex Townsend wrote. And I'm curious, first of all, your take on that kind of critique as the author. Let's talk about your thoughts about that, and then the question of therapy, medication, et cetera.
Okay. My take on that, it's interesting to hear that, but I don't agree with it, but I think that here's what I'm hearing from teens, and this is, as I said, in terms of getting the book into the right hands, what I'm hearing from teens is overwhelmingly that they do not feel heard, seen, or understood by the adults in their lives. And it's tragic to me, but this is the reality of it. And I'm glad that Alex Townsend has had a different reality, but what I'm seeing, and this is, you know, hundreds of messages every single day from teens who are suffering, and they're suffering in silence because either they feel too afraid to say anything, or they have said something and their school won't help them, their parents won't help them, their counselors won't help them, and they feel completely lost. I have heard so many times, and I'm getting very emotional right now because it's overwhelming. I've heard so many times from teens and from adults, thank you, because this book has saved my life. And it's let them know that they're not alone and that what they're feeling is not bizarre or strange or something to be ashamed of. And that means the world to me. And I've a lot, you know, kind of to answer the second question, when I get those emails, I try to make sure every single person is answered because it's important that they are heard and understood because they're not in their everyday lives. And so I have a number of resources that I give to them, not just the ones in the back of the book, but other ones and additional ones to make sure that they get the help that they're needing. Yes, they definitely need help. And Finch and Violet needed help. Finch was very private, though, about what was going on. And this is the thing I learned from my boyfriend. People around you can only see as much as you're going to let them see. And Finch was very private about that. He was intensely protective of what was happening with him because he didn't understand it. Now, if he had been diagnosed, that would be one thing, and I would hope that he would have gotten the help that he needed. But he had such a limited support system. Violet had a much better one, but she had different issues from Finch. Hers were more situational, just what she was going through. So it's an interesting question. Obviously, it's one, as you can tell, I could talk about forever, but it's something that really has overwhelmed and surprised me since the book has come out, just this response.
Well, a couple of points on that. First of all, anyone who's written a book, when that book goes out, you set this goal of, I'm going to respond to everybody. And if the book is really successful, it can be difficult to do that. What an enormous, I don't want to say burden, but certainly there is a sensitivity for you to respond because, again, you're hearing from people who haven't felt heard. And I'm just curious to know what it's like for an author to get a note that says, your book saved my life. I mean, that's got to be remarkable.
I have cried more times since January 7th when the book, you know, has been out because some of the messages are more hopeful than others. You know, so many people are now wanting to discover their bright places, and it, you know, therapy can come down the line, as some of them have said, but the thing is, in that moment, and this is kind of what Finch and Violet did for each other, they've, you know, it helped them see that the world could be, you could go through all these horrible things, but it would still be okay. You still have hope. The world is going to, you know, it's vast and it's full of possibility and it's full of bright places, even in dark, dark times. And so it is overwhelming and it's almost like a full-time job. And I know that, you know, I'm not as able as I have been to answer everyone. So I make sure to answer the people who need answers the most.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the question of medication, for example, I think of someone in my own life who has mm-hmm. depression and occasionally goes through spells where that person says, I'm strong mm-hmm. enough. I don't need medication. Medication is some kind of a sign of a weakness. And, you know, again, I don't have depression, so I can't relate to that. But I think of myself. When I have allergies, when I had a heart problem and ended up in the hospital, I'm taking medication whenever I need to. And people with depression sometimes think, well, I don't need medication. There's something with it. Finch and Violet, and really Finch, occasionally looked derisively at the impact of drugs, that it would somehow sort of peel away or dull a person's true self, it seemed. And mm-hmm. I have heard that from people in real life. And I'm curious to know, when you talk to readers, if that comes up, you know, are you sensitive to that? Are you careful with the notion of medication? Because I think Finch is absolutely reality, the way a lot of people think about it. But then I think the medical community may say, hey, medication can be life-saving. It can be very, very positive.
Absolutely, and it can be. And I mean, I like you, I haven't suffered from depression, but I have allergies. I have, you know, any number of things I have to take medicine for and have had to across the span of my life. And I have a good friend who has depression, and he does not want to be medicated, and I totally understand and respect that. At the same time, I say to him, would you, you know, suggest I don't take this medicine for allergies or whatever it is? And you know, you just have to kind of think of it in that way. And I think with Finch, I think it's not so much that he's so opposed to medicine, because that's, you know, in the book, I mean, he doesn't even know for a long time what's even happening. If this is something he can be medicated for, he's not even diagnosed. So this is the very beginning stages. And so it wasn't Finch saying, you know, drugs are horrible and you never want to be medicated. What he's really railing against is the fact that so much of his life, people have put labels on him: Crazy Finch, Theodore Freak, you know, you're worthless, you're stupid, all of these things that he has just, you know, that have just offended him and kept him in this box for so much of his life. And so what he's really railing against is just having to be labeled one more time, you know, as you are crazy or you're depressed or you're bipolar or whatever it is. And I think it's more of a reaction to what he's gone through than, you know, actual thinking about medication. But I do know people who feel, you know, they struggle with it. And then I know people who are medicated and it does wonders. And I think that's the thing. The important thing is to get help to address it. And then whatever you and your doctors feel you need to do to help yourself, no matter what it is, I think it's very important.
Yeah. And when it comes to therapy and adult interaction, I mean, you've mentioned, Jennifer, you've heard from almost countless readers, young teenagers who have said, I don't feel like people are hearing me. I don't feel connected. It doesn't feel like the adults in their lives are understanding. I know you didn't set out writing All the Bright Places with an idea that, well, now you're going to tell us how to fix therapy. I mean, that's not part of what, but I know people are reaching out to you saying these things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious to know if you've kind of come to any thoughts about how we might better find a way to connect with teenagers who are struggling, who might be depressed, who might be suicidal.
One of the most extreme people I've heard from is the girl who, 17-year-old girl, who went to her local Target, I guess, to buy sleeping pills, and because she was going to end it that day. And there was a copy of my book, for whatever reason, sitting beside the sleeping pills, so it was misshelved. She picked it up and forgot about the pills, took the book home, read it, and then wrote to me to say she'd signed up for counseling at her school and that she was going to get help. And I think that that kind of thing is just so... It just happens too much. And I think that the thing that can change is, as she said to me, you showed me that I'm not alone here, even though I felt alone my whole life. And now I know that I can do something to reach out, to let someone know how I'm feeling. Even if I don't trust the people at my school or my parents, whoever it is, I'm going to let someone know this because I shouldn't have to do this by myself. And I think that that's part of it, is just getting rid of that stigma and letting people know it's okay. I did this great panel at a recent book festival, and the topic was like, you know, I'm a basket case. And it was just authors, young adult authors saying, I have depression, I suffered loss, and I'm very sad. I, you know, have ADHD. I have, you know, this and that. Just letting teens know, like, we all have things. And There are no judgments, and it's okay to say, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, and this is what's wrong with me.
A couple of comments have come in from listeners, and I want to direct them to Jennifer Niven. We're talking to Jennifer Niven, author of All the Bright Places, a book that has become a great success in just the 4 months since it's been out, and she's going to be in Rochester on Saturday for the 10th annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest. It's at Nazareth College, and the details on that coming up in just a bit here. And Jennifer, Cynthia writes to us and says, my daughter has depression. I'm thinking about giving this book to her, but I will hope that it will offer her hope, and I'm scared that it might be too heavy, depending on the ending. You've probably heard comments like that before, I suspect.
I have. I've actually had many emails from parents asking the exact same question.
And so what would you say to Cynthia?
I would say to Cynthia, first of all, she knows her daughter far, better than I do, of course. And so ultimately, that's her decision to make. Maybe she would want to read it first and then give it to her daughter, depending on her instincts. I will say one of the first people I heard from who asked me the same question was a lovely woman in Atlanta who said, my daughter has self-harmed since she was 13. She's just out of a facility treating her, and she's 15 now. We haven't had an episode in, a year, but I'm very worried that this might be a trigger for her if I give her this book, but she really wants to read it. What do you think I should do? And I said, I can't make that decision for you, but I can share with you what other readers have said to me who have been in similar situations, who feel the same, who have self-harmed, who have been suicidal. And so I shared some of those comments with her, just saying, thank you for letting me know I'm not alone. Thank you for giving me hope. Because I like to think, with all of the heavy issues the book discusses, it's also very hopeful. And it just shows you how life can be bright in spite of the darkness. And so Margaret, her daughter, read the book and loved it, and she and I have remained friends since then, and it has helped her tremendously. And it's such an individual thing, though, that I can say, this is what's happened and this is the wonderful impact I have seen, but it is ultimately she needs to decide that.
Mark writes to us, I hope that the book doesn't present the idea that making a friend and going to fun places is going to cure what is a medical problem that needs an actual diagnosis and a doctor.
If he reads the book, he knows that is actually not at all what I'm saying. In fact, I've had so many people write to me and say, and again, I can't spoil the book, but I've had so many people write and say, but why isn't this enough to fix this? And why, if you love someone, can't you fix them? Because that's not the message here. The message is actually, you can love someone with all your heart, but it's not enough to fix a medical problem. You have to speak up and let someone know that you need help. And other people have to be more attentive. And it takes so much more than just, oh, I love this person, and I'm going to be fixed now. And I think that is the danger. That's one thing I didn't want to write and did not write here, because I think too many books do that. Like, oh, now I found the right person, and now I'm happy forever. I wish it were that simple, but it's not.
I think that is an important point here, because particularly, and again, I've got to be very careful. I am not a doctor. I'm only responding to what I've read and people I've interacted with my own life, but when there is a manic depression, there are obviously highs and lows. And sometimes there is a feeling that a road trip. I've known people who said, I just need a road trip. That'll mm-hmm. get, and you hit that high. But what happens when you come home? Well, you sort of crash again. And again, and that's speaking generally. I'm not speaking as any sort of certified doctor on this. But the book does not leave you with the impression that, hey, make a friend, find all the bright places, and it's all good after that. The book leaves you with a much more complex impression that it is important to find people who understand you and can connect with you and will try to love you and understand you for who you are. And you won't have to apologize for who you are. But even that might not be enough if you don't move beyond understanding that there is a medical component. That's all I would say to that.
That's very well said.
Jennifer, okay, last few minutes with you, real briefly here, a movie coming from all the bright places?
Yes, I'm very, very excited. There is a movie on its way.
And what more can you tell us, or can't you?
I can tell, there's not much I can say at the moment, although in a few weeks we'll be able to say more, but I can say that the I love the team that is working on this movie. They are amazing. Everyone is very passionate about the book. They're almost as invested in it as I am. They want to tell the story that's on the page. They don't want to change everything. And the person I pictured when I was writing the book as Violet is actually going to play Violet in the movie, and that's Elle Fanning. And I'm so excited about that because she's not only an amazing actress, but she's a lovely, lovely person.
Well, certainly we've heard plenty of stories of authors who have had Hollywood and studios do a lot of rewriting, and it looks, at least from the outset, that you'll have a lot of your original work intact, and so that has to feel great, and congratulations on that. Is there a timetable?
We're thinking of probably shooting early next year, so I would say the movie would probably be out in 2017, maybe early 2017, which seems far away. At the same time, I know there's a lot to do to get it ready, so I'm very excited.
And we'll see you in Rochester on Saturday.
Yes, I can't wait. I'm leaving tomorrow, and I can't wait to be there. It's an amazing festival, and I'm excited to meet readers and other YA authors.
Well, after our short break, we're going to dive into the rest of the schedule and let our listeners know how they can come out and meet you. Jennifer Niven, author of All the Bright Places, among many others, I should say. And thanks for taking the time for Connections this afternoon. It's been great talking to you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
That's Jennifer Niven. And a short break. When we come back, you'll find out how you can meet her and what else is going on with the 10th Annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest. That's after this short break. I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Healthy Friday and Second Opinion Live. We're going to enjoy the conversation with a couple of very strong-minded doctors who will help us decide myth or medicine. So if there are any questions you have about how does something really work, does it work, are certain ideas just a myth, or are they valuable medicine, we'll break it all down. Talk to you Friday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from City Blue Imaging, a commercial printer based in downtown Rochester for more than 85 years, specializing in digital color printing, trade show, and special event printing. CityBlueImaging.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guests in studio for the remainder of the hour are certainly involved with what's going on Saturday. Laura Jones is here. She is the site coordinator for the Teen Book Fest, and she's a professor in language, literacy, and technology at Nazareth College, where the festival happens to be. Great to see you, Laura.
Hi, Evan.
And thanks for being here. Charles Benoit's here as well. He has, his resume, I could do an hour just with Charles. And unfortunately,
you're more than welcome to.
He's taught in Rochester, also Kuwait, Trinidad and Tobago.
Correct.
Do you say Tobago or Tobago?
Tomato.
I see. Trinidad and Tobago, and he is an author of a number of books himself, including most recently in 2014, a book called Cold Calls. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Thank you, Charles, for being
here. Glad to be here.
All right, Laura, Saturday, Nazareth College, 10th Annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest. When to when, and give us some of the details on how people can get involved.
Okay, well, just to give you a sense of how original this type of event is and how dedicated all the people involved are, I'm sitting here today because we have at least 4 to 5 to 6 of the committee members getting their hair dyed multiple colors this year at Larry James because the teens involved in helping us raised over $10,000 to keep this festival free for all who attend. So Stephanie Squicciarini, the founder, and others are out there right now. But so when you come to campus, you're going to see rainbow hair and you're going to see tie-dyed t-shirts. And those are our 250-plus volunteers. Over 100 of them are also teens who will be welcoming you to the day. At 8:45, the authors arrive, and it's not your typical arrival. We have a red carpet, Oscar-style entrance, where everyone that's there is outside of Schultz, and they're screaming as the authors get out of their vehicles and walk through the crowds. And then there's a short break while everybody enters the gym for what I see as like some crazy combination of a rock literary festival and giant pep rally. And then at that point, Charles, who's sitting here, will be emceeing the Truth or Talent show. So all the authors, and Jennifer Niven included, will be sharing with the teens either a secret talent or a secret truth about themselves as a way to introduce themselves to the over 1,000 teens that we expect to see on campus this year. And then the rest of the day in some ways runs like any other typical day at Nazareth. All of the guests go off to sessions, and some of the authors are in single sessions and others are in panels. And those run throughout the day. And at the end of the day, we have an autographing session.
A massive autographing session.
Yes. This year, for the first year, we're not just holding it in the gym. Charles will be glad to know. We've spread out to other buildings on campus because we expect the lines to be very, very long.
So free.
Free.
And parents, if you're thinking of your young readers, what are the ages of people who come out and attend?
5th grade through 12th grade is typically the audience. Again, this is a unique festival. I mean, we have another festival here in town, obviously, the Children's Book Festival, which is another wonderful event. But this was designed 10 years ago by a group of public and school librarians here in Rochester who decided that they wanted to put together an event specifically for teens, because both in the libraries and in schools and in our communities, teens are often overlooked. And they wanted to have a place at least one day a year where teens understand that we value them, we see them essential in our community, and want to support something that they do well, which is read.
Well, I hope they do. And here's an important point for both Laura and Charles. Let me ask this. It would seem to me that the teen years are a time where we lose them as lifelong readers, or we could, that there are other distractions, there's enough with school and extracurriculars, mobile devices, everything else that goes into what can take someone's time. And if we want people to be lifelong readers, Laura, is there a concern that the teen years can be vulnerable?
Certainly. I mean, there's always been a concern that we lose kids to the wonder of books when they hit those middle school years. But that's one of the things I think is wonderful about this attention that we have now to YA literature. That, I mean, when I was growing up, there were very few books that were written for teens and about teens and what it means to come of age in whatever decade that happens to be. But now there's such a variety. I mean, you're gonna hear a little bit more about Charles' books in a moment, and we've heard about Jennifer Niven's one book with 30 authors coming. I can't tell you the spectrum of topics and ideas and stories that are really highlighted in YA literature today. And I think that helps to keep kids reading. And the Teen Book Festival, again, is about promoting recreational reading. Again, really trying to encourage and see the love that we can have for getting lost in books, as I like to say, in the right way.
Well, that's Saturday. And so they'd have to be there by when?
They can come all day long.
Absolutely.
But to be there when things really get hopping, they should be there at 10 a.m. for that opening panel, and then the first session starts at 11:15.
Charles, do you get any sense of concern that the middle school, high school years are times where we lose people as readers?
Yeah, I think we cause it. Adults cause it. We come up with these very aggressive reading lists for students. Oh, they got to read this classic. They got to read this. And forgetting that they would read what they want to read if we only gave them the time to read it. But no. Our curriculum says they have to read a book that was written by a 50-year-old white male back in the 1840s, writing for other 50-year-old white males in England, because, the kids will get so much out of it today. And I think that to not pay attention to the great stuff that's being written today with younger protagonists, that's why I don't rebel against the YA author title. I just think it pigeonholes people. I don't dumb my writing down when I write for young adults. You can't. You'll lose them instantly. The biggest difference between my adult novels and my young adult novels is the age of the protagonists, their realities, what they can know and what they can do, how they see the world. And I can't bring my adult realities and say, well, you know, you should know this by now. Well, they don't. And you have to understand things from that. I think that we have an opportunity to get more kids reading if we let them read what they want to read instead of telling them what's good for them. I always joke that you could give a you give somebody something really good. If they don't like it, it ruins them forever. And you know, they've got to find it on their own.
This is a very interesting pivot in the conversation, because we could spend a week talking about the classics. When should we read them? Should kids have to read them as part of curriculum? Because for many people listening right now, if you read To Kill a Mockingbird, if you read Catcher in the Rye, all of those things you probably read in school somewhere, not as adults. And Charles, you seem to be saying, look, classics are classics. People will find them, especially if they love to read. Maybe they'll go out and find them as adults after school. But squeezing them into curriculum and kind of drowning the reading schedule with that, can we have a detriment?
Absolutely. For example, I know you're a big fan of classical music. You sit a kid down and say, this is one of the finest works of music you are ever going to hear, and it doesn't get better. And you put it on the kid, and kid listens and goes, eh. And you've just lost them forever. They will come to it if it's really quality, if it stands the test of time, if they'll hear other people talking about it. I mean, when we're all kids, we live on Twinkies and popcorn and soda pop. And after a while, you got to have something more. Every once in a while, I want a Twinkie, but that's not my go-to dessert. Same thing with literature. Every once in a while, I want some really silly, stupid dime store novel. But I want something to be deeper, too. I want to be challenged. And I find those out. And I think that would happen to all readers. Let people binge on the light stuff, and they'll find that they're hungry for more.
Well, tell me about then the most recent book, 2014, is Cold Calls. Tell me
right,
about Cold Calls.
Right. It's a novel I wrote about. Mostly important, it's about the overwhelming, crushing, heart-stopping power that having secrets can do when you have them. Yes, and three different students who go to three different schools each get a late-night phone call, a computer-generated voice that says, I know your secret. Wow, come on, that's the oldest middle school joke. The only problem is a couple days later, the voices continue, and one day they start sending emails and sharing, oh, by the way, here's the evidence that I know your secret. The secrets are so dark and so bad that these kids agree to do anything, and that thing is to become bullies in their school. They're not out murdering somebody. They're not, you know, you must deliver heroin across the border. No, these are realistic things. Good kids in good schools suddenly are being told, you have to become the worst bully in your school, or I will expose you, and I will expose your secret. The secrets have to be bad enough that, and of course they are young adult focused and young adult centered, that the person has to realize, I must do this. They end up quickly in an anti-bullying program, and they realize, they meet through there, understanding, wow, we both share a common problem. We don't have anything in common. We don't even like each other, but we have to work together to find out who's bullying us, how they found out our secrets, and how we can stop this person before it's too late. And there's a ticking clock, and they have to get going to see if they can and find out, learn the consequences of having secrets, because we all have them, and it carries a weight in our soul.
The consequence of secrets, but bullying has been a big topic
sure.
in the last few years.
Yeah, and what would it take to turn? Everybody thinks, well, I would never be the bully. Mm-hmm. There's a reality out there that, I mean, people always think, well, I'm not the bully. Well, maybe you are. Have you ever thought to yourself that in someone's life, you're the worst thing that could happen to them is you coming into the room? I'm just kidding. I'm just joking around. They know I'm only kidding. Do they? Things become different if you start looking at yourself as potentially the worst person in the room. And is there somebody there who's thinking of me as different? No kid self-identifies as a bully. But how many of us step back and think, well, are my actions actually hurting someone else?
You also have a book from 2012 called You.
Yeah, that was my first young adult novel. It was written on a bet with my wife. She said I couldn't do it, and I had to prove her wrong. But it's written in second person, and it's a dark novel about a young kid that makes choices. It's about, all of my books are about the consequences of your choices and having to deal up. There are no adults coming to rescue at the end of my books. You have to deal with the consequences of your choices and get yourself out of them in your own means. There's no supernatural powers and suddenly, you know, go back in time and change it.
Charles Benoit, where can people find your books?
Oh, hopefully everywhere. First, start with your library, because that's always the best place to find anything you want to go. After that, Barnes and, you know, your typical big box stores okay. and your online places. They're available everywhere.
Cold Calls and You are the books for young adults, but let me at least ask you what I asked Jennifer Niven. She told me she has embraced the notion of being a young adult writer right now, that, yeah, there's always concerns about being pigeonholed, but this has become a very meaningful category for her. Other writers feel a little differently. How do you feel about it, Charles?
I don't mind being being people introducing me as a young adult writer, but I don't want them to think that somehow that means the young adult writers are writing so good. The writing is so high. If I would have known the quality of young adult writing, I would have never got into young adult. I would have stayed in adult mysteries where the writing is not nearly as good as it is in young adult.
You're saying competitive.
Oh my gosh, yes. It's so much harder. And so I love the idea. I love the challenge of writing for young adults. Adults are very polite. They will read your book and say, it was okay. Kids will walk over to you and say, I hated it. I hated it because it made me mad. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, now I like it. You know, so that kind of stuff. But young adults are very, very honest with what they like and what they don't like. And I love the challenge of writing to that audience.
All right. Well, I can't thank you both enough for coming in here and telling us what's coming up on Saturday. We had Jennifer Niven, the author of All the Bright Places, on the program earlier. She will be out there along with how many, Laura? How many authors?
30 authors.
30 authors for the 10th annual Greater Rochester Teen Book Fest on Saturday. And we got 30 seconds. So the details one more time, Laura.
It's a free event. Everyone is welcome to come. Bring your teens. Prepare to have a great day. Bring your walking shoes. And you're going to leave with at least 3, 5, and maybe even 30 new authors you want to read.
Mm-hmm. And you can meet them, which is really cool for young readers as well.
Yes.
Very cool stuff. And parents can hang as well?
Parents can hang out. Yep. And they're welcome to attend the sessions, except teens get priority.
Congratulations on putting together another great event. Have fun on Saturday. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Laura.
So much.
And Charles, again, we didn't even get to talk about teaching overseas, man.
Bring me back.
Well, you're going to have to come back. Congrats on your work, and thanks for taking the time to come in.
Thank you.
Charles Benight, author of Cold Calls, and you also participating in the festival on Saturday. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Thank you, Val Labanca, best engineer that I've had in the last 3 months, or ever, probably ever. Thank you for listening to member-supported public radio.